Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everybody. With me now for his first live interview since becoming a candidate for mayor yesterday, a one-time regular on this program during the Obamacare debate, former Brooklyn and Queens Congressman Anthony Weiner. Thanks very much for doing this. Welcome back to WNYC.
It's my pleasure. Thank you, Brian.
To deal first with the elephant in the room, what do you say to people who used to like you or do like you politically, but are frankly creeped out by the nature of your sexting scandal and lying about it to the public when it first got revealed?
Well, first, I understand it and I get it completely. And, you know, people are going to have to make a decision and I'm going to try to give them as much information as I can about it. Look, there's no doubt about it. I made very big mistakes. I compounded it immeasurably by being dishonest about it. And it's something that I regret very deeply, and I apologize to the people that supported me, and I obviously apologized many, many times to my wife. And frankly, I know that part of this process is going to be doing a lot of apologizing. And I guess what I would want people to do is to perhaps not only judge me on that, to take a look at my record of fighting for the middle class and those struggling to make it, but and I want to give them plenty of material and plenty of issues and ideas and opportunities to see me like I did this morning in the subway and on your show. And if they want to ask me about those things, I fully get it. And that's their right to do. And I guess I want to add one other thing, that even if people say, you know what, I can't get over it. I will never vote for that guy again. I hope that they would be open to hearing some of the things that I have to say on the campaign trail and letting it be part of the discussion, because I think some of them are important.
For some people, the worst of it and the most relevant part of it was that you lied publicly when your tweets were first coming to light, suggesting that your Twitter account had been hacked. Why shouldn't that raise concerns, not just about your personal behavior, but about your public integrity and how much people could trust your word as mayor?
Well, this was an enormous private failing that I was very embarrassed by. And the first, I mean, it's not, doesn't make it any better, but I was deceptive to my wife. And I was trying to conceal from my wife this embarrassing thing that I had done. And I reacted to it wrong. And I've, you know, frankly, I live with that regret. It was definitely a mistake. And I think it's an element of my private life that people can use to get a fulsome sense of who I might be. I think that's – I'm not asking people to say just forget it, pretend it never happened. I guess what I would hope that over the course of time during the campaign and reading some of the things that I've said, I gave a long interview to the New York Times Magazine to try to give some insight, and I don't know if it helped any. I thank every day my wife for giving me a second chance, and I guess what I'm saying is that I'm maybe not even asking for a second chance, meaning giving me a vote, but for now, just to give me a second chance to hear what I have to say.
How do you characterize your problem? Was it an addiction, or what word would you use?
You know, I must get several times a day, although less than I used to, a question that is some formulation of the frame, what were you thinking? And I don't know that I was. And I know that's not a satisfactory answer, and maybe it would be maybe an easier answer to say, well, I've got some addiction, or I was, you know, abused as a child or something else. It's none of those things. It was simply a blind spot. It was a thoughtlessness that I had about my private behavior and my, you know, things that I was doing in my private life that unfortunately in all too public a way became a public conversation. But I don't have a good explanation.
Any other shoes to drop on this that maybe you want to get out yourself before somebody else does?
Well, I can. It is what it is, in that, you know, New Yorkers have seen, frankly, people all over the world have seen. I did these inappropriate things over an extended period of time with more than one person. I've frankly turned other people's lives upside down who are at the other end of these communications, and these women are not public figures, but people may decide they want to come forward and say, here's another email that I got or another photo that I got, but I'm certainly not going to do that. And so people may hear things that are true. They may hear things that are not true, but I'm going to try to keep leaning forward and talking about the issues important to New York City.
And one more thing on this, then we'll talk about running the city of New York. Why shouldn't people be wary that something like this could happen again and become a distraction from doing your job as mayor? Stuff wasn't supposed to happen again with Bill Clinton when he was elected president, but he apparently couldn't help himself even in the Oval Office.
Well, look, this is something that, you know, my wife and I have gone through some difficult – I put her through some very difficult things. And we work on this, and it's – you know, she says it's in the rearview mirror, but it's not far in the rearview mirror. I have learned some difficult lessons, and I have put these things behind me. I am trying to move forward and talk about the things that I care about. But this behavior is regrettable. I deeply regret it. It hurt me and my family very much. It let down a lot of people, and it's behind me.
And you're how confident that it won't happen again?
It is behind me.
So why do you want to be mayor?
You know, I've been animated for the longest time by this idea of what New York is, and it's to some degree, I look at it through the lens of my own experience as someone who grew up a middle-class kid in Brooklyn and someone whose grandparents didn't, you know, in some cases my grandparents, my great-grandparents on my father's side came to this city because it is a place that provides a ladder that essentially into the middle class for people and that from there anything is possible. And my experience, you know, having a mother as a school teacher for 31 years in the public school system, going to public schools myself, you know, my entire life. You know, my mother and father, you know, whenever I think that I've got some brilliant idea, my mother and father remind me that in 1963, they bought a limestone duplex on a park block in Park Slope for about $50,000. So suddenly anything I do doesn't seem so smart after they made that smart investment. But if you think about that experience that I've just described, housing is virtually impossible to find at an affordable rate right now. The schools are shaky, and the 31-year veteran like my mother is hard to find in the school system nowadays. And the good, solid jobs with benefits, those kinds of three legs of the stool are all of them under distress right now. And I said it when I ran for mayor in 2005, and I've fought for it ever since. And I still believe it, that we cannot be a sustainable city that doesn't have that middle class rung of success to let people climb into the middle class.
Why do you think you'd be better at this than the other candidates who've been running for longer and getting their ideas out?
I'm not sure they've been running for longer. I mean, I came pretty close when I ran in 2005. You know, there's a lot of talk about Mike Bloomberg's third term. I fought to deny him a second term.
Well, they've been running for longer this year.
And so I've been talking about a lot of these ideas for the longest time. I put out an idea book called keystothecity.com, .org. It's at the website anthonywiener.com. And the New York Times read it and says, this sounds an awful lot like what he said in 2005 and 2007 and 2009, as if plagiarizing for myself was a great crime. Look, these are things that really animate me, and I put a lot of thought into the ideas that I've talked about. And I also think something else. I think that if we as Democrats don't reclaim the mantle as the party of ideas here in New York City, that we're not just running campaigns that are constantly revolving around the notion, I'm not the other guy or I'm not my predecessor – that here's the aspirational view that we have going forward, then we're going to keep losing. And so I think to some degree I'll let the other candidates speak for themselves, but that's my thinking about the vision I have for the race from my perspective.
Mayoral candidate Anthony Weiner with us on WNYC. You know, we had Andrew Wolf on the show the other day who wrote an article in support of you in the conservative online publication The New York Sun. This is what's left of the old New York Sun. He called you the most moderate of the Democratic hopefuls, compared you to Ed Koch, who he liked, and said you are, quote, unencumbered by labor union demands and the traditional power brokers of the irrational left. How much of that New York Sun description of you do you agree with?
Well, I don't know. I mean, look, I'm someone who proposes in my idea book the notion of a single-payer healthcare system for New York City revolving around all the hospitals, nursing homes, the number of doctors that we have on payroll. We've been closing hospitals. It's mind-boggling. We can have 1.2 million uninsured in this city, and we don't see the possibilities of creating a single-payer healthcare system for New York. So maybe that is a conservative position. I don't know. It certainly saves money, and I know that I believe it. Some people might characterize that as irrational left thinking. I don't believe that. I believe that the middle class in the city and those struggling to make it, I think we should try to reduce their taxes. And I think that we can make it up by saying we should have a more progressive tax for these oligarchs and potentates that are buying $20 million apartments in New York City and basically paying the same rate as a neighborhood guy in Sunnyside. So I just don't buy the idea that progressives don't want smarter tax policy, don't want lower crime, don't think there are better ways to provide health care. I just don't believe that. But I will say there is an element of truth to the idea that I'm probably not going to be the candidate of other elected officials and big institutions. But that doesn't mean that I'm going to wage a campaign attacking them. I mean, frankly, I want every member of these unions to support me, and I'll let someone else figure out what box they want to put me in an ideology.
Well, you mentioned healthcare. Last night, I read your booklet, Keys to the City, 64 Ideas to Keep New York the Capital of the Middle Class. I read all 64 ideas, and I noticed that you called on healthcare for asking city workers to begin to pay part of their health insurance premiums. You also proposed requiring higher premiums from city workers who smoke. Is this unusual from somebody who champions single-payer health insurance?
Well, there's got to be two parts of this to solve this problem. First of all, everyone has to I firmly believe that there should be some element of participation by people who get health insurance for one very important reason. It makes the marketplace work better. If you pay a little bit more and you see the price go up, you go to your benefit manager and say, wait a minute, why is my price going up? I want that price to go down.
But single payer, real single payer like you champion in Washington is the opposite of
that.
Yeah,
here's what's going to happen.
Everybody pays into the general tax pot and then nobody pays out of pocket when they get health care.
Right. Here's what's going to happen is that under my proposal, and what I basically say is if you take all of the money that we pay now for employees, for retirees, for the uninsured that are going to emergency rooms, for the care that we get at the Health and Hospice Corporation, for example, you've got roughly 20% of the budget. It's $14 billion. And I do believe that ultimately you take that money and you don't provide health insurance in the classic sense that you buy a policy and then send 20% of the overhead to someone else, that we keep it here in-house and use it for health care. But that doesn't mean there should be zero barriers to entry. And it also doesn't mean we're going to be able to do it next year when we have to enter into all these contracts with municipal unions. So I guess the point that I'm making is that everyone – I mean in the near term, we're not going to be able to do away with the private model immediately. I think it's going to take us a couple of years to do it. But ultimately what we're going to have in this city if I become mayor and if this works, we're going to have a single-payer system that I think we should make New York City the laboratory for single-payer health care because no one can do it like New York City.
But in the meantime, higher premiums for city workers who smoke? Will you next want higher premiums from workers who are obese or ride motorcycles?
No, but – well, the motorcycle thing, I guess, is a closer thing because it's a choice. I think it's perfectly reasonable to say to people that make a decision that add the cost to the rest of us that they should bear that cost. I think it's a reasonable thing to say. I don't believe that smoking is not like obesity that has all kinds of genetic reasons. And frankly, we should try to help. And in exchange, we should continue programs to try to help people not smoke. But I think it's reasonable to say that if someone's going to smoke and drive up everyone's costs, they should bear that cost.
So does this position indicate that you will not be competing for public sector union endorsements?
You know, here's what I'm going to say to municipal employees. Right now, healthcare is in the next 4 years going to go up 40%. That is money we can't use for raises. Bottom line, we can't use for new social programs. We can't use to fix our parks. We can't use to provide daycare. So, more importantly to them, there's a reason why payrolls and salaries have been flat in this country and down in New York City among middle class people. Every single dime that's been available to employers, meaning the city, is going into healthcare. And where's that money going? To insurance companies. It is an imperative, just as I argued when we had the debate on national health care, it is an imperative to workers to want to deal with this health care problem. And I believe that the deal is going to be this. You put a few dollars more in on the health care side, I will bring you a single-payer health care system. And secondly, you'll be able to get more raises because it really is a situation that health care is gobbling up everything else.
Well, let me ask you this. Is it a fundamental conflict of interest for a mayoral candidate to accept endorsements from public sector unions, since that's who you're going to have to be negotiating with or negotiating against when you do the contract deals?
Well, theoretically, all 8.1 million people in the city are interests of their own. And yes, I want to look, I don't view – I've never viewed campaigns as one interest group or another. I think there are enough unifying ideas in our city that you can run a campaign that when you go to where I was this morning in Harlem and talk to them about health care, that's just as understandable there as it is in Rockaway. I just don't buy the analysis but I do believe this. I believe that we should look at the leadership of unions as having a conversation with those members. But I hope that if a labor union supports one of my opponents, I'm obviously going to want every one of their members to support me.
Are you planning to meet with the UFT leadership, which is currently deciding who to endorse? And I saw a quote from Michael Mulgrew, the union president, saying, hey, we're on this process. Anthony Weiner can come and talk to us.
Absolutely. Look, my mom was a school teacher for 31 years, a card-carrying member of the UFT. She whispers in my ear lots of things about teachers all the time and about the classroom. But I have to tell you this. if I don't get the UFT endorsement, that doesn't mean I'm not going to try every single day to persuade every teacher and every supervisor and every staff member that I want their vote. And I'll tell you something else. If I don't get the support of a union, that doesn't mean that if I'm fortunate enough to get elected, that I'm not going to say I'm going to have to work with all of these people.
In the education section of Keys to the City, your policy book, you have nothing at all on the big recent issues like how to evaluate teachers or whether to close failing schools as aggressively as Mayor Bloomberg has. Does that mean you support the mayor's positions?
No. Frankly, you'll see a lot of the hot button issues I left out of this book. I mean, part of the conversation I think we need to have is we need to expand beyond the five or six issues that everyone seems to be talking about, because I think – and one of the points I was trying to make here is that there's a lot more stuff out there that people should be thinking about. Look, I think – I mean, the way I look at the Bloomberg administration is that they did a laudable thing to begin with, and they said, let's get control of the system and let's put a lot more money into it. And it's undeniable that, frankly, it's the only part of the budget that has really grown a great deal if you put aside health care and pensions and things like that. I think there have been some crucial mistakes that were made. And I think that it has led to a situation where, frankly, you have teachers that are chafing so much at their employer that it's just not healthy. And I also think
reliance on standardized tests, expansions of charter schools, co-locations, the evaluations, all those things?
Let's do them one at a time.
How many of them are mistakes? Yeah, I want to get some other topics in there too, so briefly.
You give me a 9-part question with 3 subdivisions. I've got to try to catch up with you. So – look, I think there are too many standardized tests, and a bigger mistake I think we're making is too much relying on state tests. I think we have to take a look not how we're comparing, you know, the Bronx to Staten Island. We got to think about how we're comparing to Pittsburgh and otherwise. And I think taking a snapshot of those national tests is as important as anything we're doing locally. I find myself racing to catch up here. Go ahead, Brian. Do you want to throw some more out at me? You seem like you want to
just
hop
one
in here.
One more from that list.
Sure.
The co-locations, the charter schools.
I don't believe
public school
here's
buildings.
Here's what I think. First of all, there are school buildings in this city that have space. One of the reasons they have space is that parents are abandoning those neighborhoods, abandoning those public schools. I think that we should have a conversation about where we want how we want to use that space. I frankly believe that there should be gifted and talented programs in schools that we try to use to attract parents to those communities, attract good teachers to those communities. I don't have an objection of co-locating charter schools and public schools where there are space. I do believe that we should not have a competition for space in the areas where there is not, and we should to increase overcrowding that way. That's not I don't think that helps anybody.
Also under education in your book, idea number 5, you propose to make Catholic school preservation a public school issue. Do you want tax dollars used to help private religious schools?
Well, here's what I do want. You know, we've lost 63, I think, parish schools in the last 5 years, and we're due to lose another 20 at the end of the year. That is a real problem for New York City. First of all, it's a cultural problem. I think that the parish schools, particularly growing up in Brooklyn, is so much part of the fabric of the city. But it's a real crisis situation for the overcrowding that we have in our public schools. And what have we done? Rather than try to help these Catholic schools, rather than see if we can help them in purely secular ways of trying to ease some of their burdens, and rather than saying to the folks at Tweed, you know, let's see what we can do with public dollars that they're entitled to anyway, things like book money, and let's see if we can figure out ways to help. We've kind of swooped in and tried to, you know, make use of the property instead. We've made it much too difficult for parish schools in this city, and they are an asset, and we should all mourn when they disappear.
So what's the public sector's role in that? And would you consider a private or religious school voucher program?
No, here's what I think we can do. First of all, there's all kinds of secular services we provide to non-public schools, things like book money and computers and health care and security and these different types of things. So there are plenty of ways that we can be helpful and supportive, just as we could any other. Let's consider than any other nonprofit. I believe one of the ideas in my book is to create a nonprofit czar. Like, too often we see the silos of responsibility wrong. There are many people in the nonprofit sector who are doing all kinds of virtuous things that help New York City taxpayers, that help New York City do its job. So I just think that we have to have a little more sensitivity and see it as more of our mission to have education as more of a cornucopia of options rather than simply.
The Constitution doesn't require that you treat religious schools differently from other nonprofits in terms of public funding?
Quite the opposite. There are many elements of public funding that you're required by district and by neighborhood to give the very similar funding to private schools. Now, it's not the curriculum in nature, obviously, has to, but things like support services, absolutely, parochial schools have every right to.
Let me get a a couple of more issues in here. We have about 5 minutes left with Anthony Weiner, now running for mayor officially. I moderated a mayoral candidates forum on environmental issues the other week, and I asked all the candidates to raise their hands if they support the 91st Street Waste Transfer Station by the East River, and only Christine Quinn raised her hand. How about you?
Raising hands doesn't really work well on the radio, but I oppose the waste transfer station. I mean, look, part of the – I understand the social justice rationale, but frankly, a lot of the waste that goes from Manhattan Island goes directly out of Manhattan. Quickly, it's not like it's going to Brooklyn or going to somewhere else. I think one of the great things that we did was kind of reclaiming that piece of public space for Asphalt Green, and I thought it was great ideas of how the city evolves and takes advantage of communities and neighborhoods that perhaps were not hospitable. And I don't see an economic rationale. It seems to me a more of a talking point rationale to have the waste transfer station there, and I oppose it.
Would you consider do you consider stop and frisk unconstitutional? You know a judge is going to rule on that now.
I don't believe the tactic is unconstitutional. I believe that – I mean, I don't – frankly, I think
as practiced currently by the Bloomberg administration.
Here's what I do believe. I believe that how it's been – let's separate the two things. You know, the notion of having police officers see someone who's acting suspiciously, have reasonable cause to believe they're about to commit a crime or they have committed a crime. I think there's broad consensus in this city. The police officer observes that. We want them to stop them and stop them from committing that crime. This is a policy question. The mayor has a policy – of trying to get people to go into their pockets to take out small amounts of marijuana so they can justify arrests. Policy is to get as many 250s when you go out on these forms filled out as you can. That's how they're measuring success. That policy is wrong. That policy must change. Now, I don't believe the act of a stop and frisk is unconstitutional, but I can tell you that the way this policy is being done is disenfranchising large communities and eroding one of the mayor's primary, I think, one of the things that he can be most proud of is the way that he's reduced racial tension in the city since the Giuliani years. And slowly but surely, it's getting chipped away at by the way that policy has been done. But I definitely believe police should have the right that should be part of the – one of the arrows in the quiver of a police officer is using that stop, interview, and frisk.
And I see in your briefing book, also on public safety, that you propose to expand DNA fingerprinting to as many people arrested for – minor crimes as possible. Now, you know civil libertarians won't like that. They see that as much more invasive than regular fingerprinting. Not only do they have to go in and scrape your cheek inside your mouth, I guess that's the way it's done, but then they'd have all your genetic information on file. Right. Why are you for that?
Well, that's actually not right. I mean, the DNA swab that's traditionally done, it's done for a lot of crimes. It's done for everyone who's incarcerated. It's done for crimes presently. Does not take the long genetic chain. It just is for use for identifying purposes. Look, this is a primary civil liberties issue of our day. The number of people that are falsely arrested, the number of people who don't have access to information to exonerate themselves. DNA is a tool that helps us make sure we get the right person and don't get the wrong person. The idea that DNA is probably used as often to exonerate people as it is to convict someone. So this is – we now take a fingerprint. This is arguably less invasive than sitting there and doing the fingerprints. It is something that is not particularly problematic. And by the way, right now we have hundreds and hundreds of rape kits that every day need to get processed looking for evidence on who did those crimes. If we provide more information into the database, we will free people who did not commit crimes as much as we will catch new people.
Are you going to go out on the mayoral candidates forum trail? You know, they've done scores and scores of these. It's like a full-time job for the candidates so far this year, going from mostly interest group sponsored to interest group sponsored mayoral forums. Are you going to join that group? Because basically, almost all of them are going to almost all of them.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I opened up the spigot yesterday. I have started a website at anthonyweiner.com where people are sending us invitations. We're literally going through them as they come in. I'm going to one this evening in Riverdale, which is a candidate. I don't know what the different terminology is. It's like a candidate forum. I'm going to see. I'm going to try to get to as many places as I can, and I'm also going to try to, you know, to reach voters in less conventional ways.
I'll catch you up on one question from one forum this week. Greg David, who did the Crane's New York Business Forum, asked the Democratic candidates to rate Mayor Bloomberg on a scale from 1 to 10. How would you have answered?
I ran against Mike Bloomberg once. I'm not eager to do it again. I think there are many elements of his legacy that he should be – that he commended for, the way he tries to innovate and think of ideas. Even if you don't like them, the idea that he leans forward and things like the 2030 plan, the way that he's, as I said earlier, reduced racial tensions in the city. But obviously my record is well documented of many places where I have parted with him. But I think that it is – I don't think it does justice to the conversation to reduce it to a number.
So one more Bloomberg policy before you go, because I was a little surprised to see in your briefing book, item 19, give breaks to employers who promote biking to work, since you famously said to Mayor Bloomberg in 2010 that if you become mayor, you're, quote, going to have a bunch of ribbon cuttings tearing out your effing bike lanes. And you didn't say effing. Have you changed on this?
I have not. I've got – look, here, I'm going to hold up my bike share tag. You know, I love bicycling. I hope that more people do it. I look forward to the bike share program. It was a joke. I don't think I'll be having ribbon cuttings to do that. But I can tell you this. I think that they succeeded in taking a unifying issue, the thing that people agree upon in the city. They like bicyclists. They like biking. And they made it a divisive one. And it shows you how you manage the city and how you pursue the job as mayor manages how it influences how these issues get considered. Now you have people who are venomous about bike lanes, who that if we had a smarter policy with more conversation and more consideration, then I think the policy you probably would have gotten to this to a very similar place without having funny conversations like that. And by the way, I wasn't the only one having that conversation. A lot of people talk about it. But I love bikes, and I would point people to the idea in my book, which is to mirror the federal tax benefit that people get when they help their workers find bike equipment, find places to park it and the like. I think that's some way the city can help.
Are there any bike lanes that you would take out? Any ones in particular? Prospect Park West?
I don't like the bike lane in Prospect Park West. I mean, I don't know if we're going to go back and I reserve the right to do things and policies and propose things as I get. I'm not getting wrecking crews out or ribbon cutting started. You know, I've not been a fan of that one, but I understand that people are, and I'm not looking to relitigate every bike lane in the city.
We're about out of time. I'll give you a minute to say anything you want to the voters as you launch your campaign.
Well, look, I just want people to maybe give me a second chance to talk about some of these issues. And so far, the response has been very good. And at anthonyweiner.com, I've got 64 ideas, and I'm going to put out more ideas all the time. And I think that if we're going to win, if Democrats are going to win back City Hall, it's going to be because we do two things. One is to focus like a laser beam on the challenges of the middle class and those struggling to make it. And the second is to bring real forward-looking ideas on how we're going to get things done to give people a sense. I believe voting is fundamentally an aspirational thing. It's about looking forward. And I would like to do that looking forward in more ways than one.
Anthony Weiner, now running for mayor. Thank you for coming on. We'll keep talking.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, we'll preview President Obama's national security speech scheduled for this afternoon. He's expected to discuss a reduction in drone strikes and a new push to close the prison at Guantanamo Bay. Stay with us.